And good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Interoperability Standards Workgroup. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and we are always glad to see that you can join us. We do have a few guest presenters with us today, and I'd like to welcome and thank them for their participation. All workgroup meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is always welcomed, which could be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 11:55 Eastern Time this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our work group members. So when I call your name, please indicate if you are here. And let's start with our co-chairs, Sarah DeSylvie.
I am here.
Nerys Thunder Rajan.
I'm here.
Pooja Babra.
Good morning, I'm here.
Shyla Bland.
Present.
Ricky Bloomfield.
Good morning, I'm here.
Hans Wittendijk.
Good morning.
Christina Carabayo will not be able to join us today. Grace Cordovano.
Good morning.
Raj Dash. I see Raj on, so he was here. Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Nidra Garrett.
Good morning.
Raj Goodparty.
Good morning.
Bryant Thomas Karras. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Sung Liu.
Good morning.
Meg Marshall.
Hi, good morning, I'm here.
Anna McAllister. Clem McDonald. Devin McGraw.
Good morning, I'm here.
Aaron Neary. Aaron Einstein.
Good morning, I'm here.
Kike Lomo, Ocean Canton. Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Michelle Schreiber.
Good morning.
Shelley Spiro.
Testing.
Good morning.
And Ram.
Good morning, I'm here.
Ram Sriram, you see it. Good morning.
Thank you, Ram. Thank you, everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Sarah and Rish for their opening remarks.
Hi there, this is Anna McAllister. I jumped on just after you called my name. Just letting you know.
Great. Thank you, Anna.
Greetings, Sarah, everybody. Maybe? Yeah. It's Narsh and my honor to bring us to our next installment of our ISWG. We have a interesting agenda today because we took your suggestions and integrated guest speakers who are critical subject matter experts in a couple of the elements of reference. So brief review of the charge, and then welcoming our AHA friends to discuss physical activity assessment, and Lloyd McKenzie to discuss that as well as part of the HL7 work in that ecosystem. And then we will move to medication instructions and medication adherence, welcoming Scott Robertson. And then after the conclusion of those two elements of public presentation of subject matter experts, we'll go into a brief dive into some of the existing level two data elements that were recommended so far by workgroup members. We also will try to integrate the findings of the little task force that Hong led regarding definitions of procedure time. They were tasked to do definitions that were built off of our conversation at a previous meeting, and they've completed that work, and you can find that in the draft comments on the share drive. They've uploaded those comments and discussion there. We'll then just review the work plan and timeline again. We're making great headway on our work. We have a few more guest speakers to come in the weeks ahead. We'll open up public comment and then we will adjourn. Naresh, anything to add?
No, Sarah. I think this is exactly what we need to do for today. Thanks a lot for all your contributions so far.
Wonderful. All right. Next slide, please. Next slide. We do this every meeting as a level setting, again, just reviewing our charge here in the Interoperability Standards Workgroup. Our primary first element of the charge, well, in general, it is to evaluate draft USCDIV4 and provide HITECH with recommendations on two specific subtopics. One is those new data classes and elements from draft USCDIV4. Again, we've made significant headway and touched upon at least in some way each of the elements. since the IndraQuest IV, and I'm very grateful for all of our work on that, doing deep dives on some of the elements, specifically inviting our guest speakers, and there are also some subgroups working on definitions to bring back to the crew. And our next task is to reevaluate and evaluate any level two data classes and elements not included in draft USDAID IV. Again, per the agenda, if we do have time at the end of our subject matter expert presentations, we will hope to get into that today and in the upcoming meetings. Any questions on the charge? Okay, next slide. This is the rough view of where we stand. Everything green had consensus on moving forward. Everything that is in yellow is a work in progress. Some of the elements that are yellow have yet to be really addressed yet because we're waiting for subject matter experts. Some of them have been addressed. We just are seeking a refinement and kind of doing a more granular analysis in the discussion elements. And we will revisit them before the end of our work here. So yellow is discussed but not finalized. Green is having achieved consensus to move forward. And again, you can see that we've covered everything so far, at least briefly. Next slide, please. And now it is again our honor to pass the mic to our colleagues, the American Heart Association and Lloyd McKenzie, to talk about the work that's being done at HL7 regarding the physical activity system.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Naresh, and to the entire work group for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Laurie Witzel. I'm National Vice President of Policy Research for the American Heart Association, and I also help support and lead the Physical Activity Alliance. We are a national 501c3 that's really bringing the physical activity community together to speak with one voice on policy and systems change. And one of our key projects is the one that we're talking with you about today, is our effort to make physical activity assessment, prescription, and referral a standard of care in the US healthcare system. We're calling this work It's Time to Move, and it's a multi-pronged, multi-year effort integrating with a number of federal regulatory agencies. But we can go to the next slide if that's okay. While we're doing that, I wanna introduce Paul Chase on my team, who's helping to manage this project, and of course, Lloyd McKenzie, who is our technical consultant and expert helping us navigate the HL7 pathway. We have been in HL7 for about a year now, making incredible progress. We'll be bringing our implementation guide to ballot this spring, and Lloyd can answer technical questions regarding the IG, but we're also concurrently doing this application with ONC to get it our work included in USCDI. But we did, in that process, in the IG development, settle on core measures for physical activity. So our ONC application really addresses physical activity assessment. In the implementation guide, we're doing the whole continuum of assessment, prescription, and referral, trying to standardize measures along that whole continuum. But the assessment measures that we settled on are based on, are aligned with the physical activity guidelines for Americans, validated in the peer-reviewed literature, and involve a question on muscle strengthening activity, as well as aerobic physical activity, getting us to moderate to vigorous physical minutes of physical activity per week. And there are LOINC codes associated with each, and we're staying, you know, true to those LOINC codes in the implementation guide. We could go to the next slide. We know that so we're building on the work, a lot of the great work that's been happening for many, many years in building physical activity assessment into healthcare delivery. These are just some examples of the health systems that are already doing this. And I would just highlight, because Kaiser Permanente has had physical activity assessment, and actually the questions that we've proposed in our implementation guide in their system, they were able during COVID to correlate patients' physical activity levels with their COVID outcomes, and were able to publish in the peer-reviewed literature on physical activity being a key way to improve COVID outcomes, both hospitalization and mortality. So that was then picked up by CDC, who did a comprehensive review and incorporated then physical activity as a recommendation in public health guidance. So it's an example of physical activity being there in the EHR, that assessment being there, has been really critical to correlating physical activities with other chronic disease outcomes as well as infectious disease outcomes. Next slide. And these are important links to our project, our homepage in HL7 Confluence homepage, and then our draft implementation guide. And obviously listserv, we're glad to keep, we've been inviting any stakeholder that wants to join us to this work. And we already have a really robust set of expert advisors and stakeholders that are helping us in the HL7 process. So I think that's all of our slides. We really wanted to leave lots of time for questions, of course, and conversation. Lloyd, I would turn it to you for any comments that you'd like to make on the measures or technical part of the IG.
Sure. My understanding is that there had been a question raised previously about whether we were comfortable with the way physical activity was represented in the proposed USCDI measure, in that it just points to link in general rather than to specific codes. Short answer is we're happy to have it there, period. We chose specific codes in the implementation guide and in our submission because there are specific codes within LOINC that correlate with national guidelines. And there's a lot of potential codes in LOINC that deal with different aspects of physical activity, how many steps you've done, various cardiac assessments, et cetera. And yes, it's great to have any or all of those things, but what we're really looking for is those primary measures as something that everybody does so that we can properly screen and evaluate. In our implementation guide, we also have a number of supporting measures to help better evaluate why you're not getting to target levels. But what we're really hoping for in sort of the national standard is getting everybody to at least do those primary measures. And that's why we had proposed the specific LOINC codes, but we'll take what you give us.
Thanks, Lloyd. So we'd love to answer any questions. Turn it over to discussion.
Mark?
Thanks. Can we go back to the slide with the core measures on it, please? This is mostly a question for my understanding. As I read these core measures, they looked like they are structured around what we might think of as exercise. And I can think of lots of things happening out there in the world where it doesn't necessarily qualify as exercise per se, but there's a lot of muscle strengthening, a lot of aerobic physical activity. So somebody working in a warehouse, lifting boxes, muscle strengthening, the people who kindly empty our garbage and recycling on their trucks, they are jumping up and down, moving really fast. And I just wanted to check, do these four core measures capture that kind of physical activity as well? They don't. I would not have thought of including those kinds of things the way they're written, and so that's why I'm checking.
Thanks, Mark, for asking it. It is validated in the literature that these questions are capturing both leisure time physical activity and exercise, as well as occupational level. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Stephen?
Yeah, I'm certainly happy to vouch for that from the clinical perspective, that these are the standard questions that I've seen used and that as a provider have utilized them to capture physical activity and occupational activities as well. You know, I also wanted to provide a little bit of context from prior work of this group and its successors, where there is definitely precedent for recommending specific LOINC codes to be included coming from our work group. And I think also I like this idea that was presented that, you know, this is the core set. You know, we don't want to ask for the world, but if we ask for a modest number of codes, oftentimes we can get that included. And like so many other things, SDOH included labs, you know, it's okay to start with a small set and know that we could move forward in the future as appropriate for further additions to USCDI. But I certainly personally support this subset for inclusion.
Thank you, Stephen. Al?
Thanks, Sarah. Lori, this is, I'm not sure if everybody is aware, ONC, going back to 2015, developed some certification criteria around physical activity in an optional criteria related to, which also introduced some of the social determinants of health data elements. There is a slight difference in the first of the physical activity codes that you use. The one in this particular, in your particular measure, is average per week over the last 30 days. And the data element that ONC adopted back in 2015 is in the last 7 days, so not an average over a month. And I just wanted to see if A, were aware, B, had any comments on the differences between those two. I understand, you know, average over a month, weekly average over a month is different than in the last 7 days, because I may have just started something or just stopped something, and that would impact it. So, but ONC has adopted different versions of those first two physical activity measures into certification already.
Thanks for raising that, Al. And as you say, we were really trying to adhere to what we know is validated. And as you say, 30 days is from the literature, is a better measure of kind of consistent behavior in physical activity over time. So, that's why we did use the 30-day measure, but really appreciate that you guys have started in this space. It's an important foundation.
Thank you, Al and Lori. Ricky?
Thank you. Thanks to the team for coming to present this. I think this is exciting work, and I think is meaningful. One of the questions that has come up in our discussion within the work group has been around when we think about new data types added to USCDI, we want to make sure that they represent data that is already captured in a structured way in the EHR, so that what this does is make sure that that data, when it comes out of the EHR, is done in a standard way. Do you have any data, or have you done any surveys on how many EHRs record this data in a structured way today, and what the scope of that would be, or would adding this data to USCDI require some sort of change in workflow on behalf of the providers in order to capture this in a way that then could be applied here using this these link codes?
Ricky, thanks so much for asking that question, and thank you for being one of those experts helping to inform our work. So it is, if by our understanding, about 30% of EHRs have this capability now to ask these questions, based on the work that ONC's done and that Exercises Medicine has been driving over the last many years. So there is already a significant percent of EHRs that have this capability. In terms of changing workflow, I mean, this is, where we hope to continue to drive both patient and provider workflow with this standardization. To us, this measure standardization was foundational to helping to drive the implementation, uptake, and workflow that will come in health systems. And we know of a number of health systems that have recently reached out to us that are now interested in beginning to do this work. So I feel like there's a snowball effect here, and we've got a pretty good percent now who are already making this part of standard of care, but we have a long way to go to get this completely to national scale.
Great, thank you.
Thank you all. Shelley?
Thank you. That was a great presentation. On the behalf of the long-term and post-acute care setting, physical activity plays a very important role in strategies in managing frailty, which is one of the key indicators for activities of daily living and measuring activities of daily living. This is a really important data element to make sure that this is part of an interoperable exchange. I'm in definite support of moving forward with that using LOINC for this data element. Thank you.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. We are hearing a lot in terms of frailty, and this work that we're doing is across the lifespan, so from children to older adults, and really appreciate your comment about this being important to address osteoarthritis and balance and frailty. We know that's really important for a lot of patients.
Thank you, Shelley and Lori. On to Devin.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for this. When I look at aerobic physical activity, bullet number two, on the days the patient engages in moderate to vigorous exercise, how many minutes on average do they exercise? You know, I'm no exercise expert, but I'm a bit of a dilettante, and I sort of read through this stuff. And I know that there has been a growing body of literature that you don't necessarily need 20 straight minutes of aerobic activity, but that spurts of it throughout the day can also be very beneficial. I assume that in bullet number two, that, you know, when patients report this, which they will, that there is some instruction around, you know, those minutes don't have to all be together, right? It can be 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the middle of the day, 5 minutes at the end of the day, et cetera. And then my other question is, you know, 2018, I think the science on this continues to evolve as it does in so many of the areas that we touch on. 2018 feels a little outdated to me, but maybe not so much. So I'm sort of curious how often those guidelines get updated, and we don't want this stuff to get ossified too quickly.
Right. Yeah. No, thank you. That's such an important question. So you're absolutely right. In the 2018 guidelines, it was one of the major changes in the guidelines that you could accumulate smaller bouts of physical activity throughout the day. And there absolutely, that would be part of this number two. This would be the accumulation of those minutes throughout the day, not just in one bout. And to answer your question about how often the physical activity guidelines are updated, right now it's every 10 years. Unlike the dietary guidelines, which are in statute by Congress to be updated every 5 years, the physical activity guidelines are not in congressional statute. We're trying to change that. It's one of the things we're working on as part of this work. But right now, the Department of Health and Human Services on its own has done these physical activity guidelines, and they're on a 10-year, every 10-year schedule. They do a mid-course update. Right now, actually, the current mid-course update has a focus on older adults and is out for public comment. That's kind of an area of, you know, focused area where evidence might be changing within the 10 years. But for the most part, the physical activity guidelines are a 10-year process. And so the next iteration will be in 2028, if all goes as planned.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I can answer your question regarding the bullet point number two with the accumulation of minutes of exercise throughout the day. There are instructions. So one place that they can be found is the paper that's cited down below from 2012 with the initial validation of the vital sign that has specific instructions in there. And then there's also a separate document. So that'll come, you know, as we sort of educate the uptake of the RIG that's sort of in the plan too.
Thanks, Paul. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
On to Ike.
Hey, good morning. I think I've got three or four questions or observations. First, looking at the anaerobic physical activity, third bullet seems to be derived from the first two elements, looking at days, times, minutes. So I'm not sure we necessarily need to incorporate the product of X times Y in the same space. Secondly, I would envision that there might be some deviation across a year, particularly as you look at people in colder environments where they may be more active during certain times of the year than others. And I'm just kind of curious, not from a standard standpoint, but how that fits in to the puzzle. A third piece is an observation of looking at how we're using this type of data, because not every patient is capable of meeting a standard recommendation for reasons that are directly related to biology. For example, I'll pick on myself because I'm an easy target. For me, given my particular biology, muscle strengthening exercises are actually really bad for my health. At the end of the day, if I overstrain my muscles, they will turn into bone permanently. So I want to make sure, again, not so much from a standards perspective, but the usability of the data and making sure that we're going down a path that uses the information to inform, but not make decisions about activities or evaluate physicians or other caregivers based on patient activities. I think that's all I've got to say.
Great, thank you. Those are all great questions. So the reason we have the multiplication is because that then aligns the final information with the physical activity guidelines. So we can see total minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity per week. And that tells us if a patient is just starting on their journey to be more physically active, if they are already meeting the guidelines, or if they're, you know, sedentary. And then that this is why the conversation is so important in the health, starting in the health system, because then, as you say, it is really important then to tailor the next step, the potential prescription and referral based on the patient. That should all be individualized based on this initial screening, this initial assessment. So we absolutely wouldn't want to have some standard recommendation across all patients. It would be totally tailored to their current health needs, functional capacity, what they're capable of. And starting that conversation with their provider, with their clinician is really, really critical. In terms of seasonality, there's some indication of seasonality, and I'm going to maybe ask Paul to go into this. I haven't seen that it's a significant issue because a lot of people will adapt their physical activity levels, moving inside when it's colder, outside when it's nicer. That also ties into all the other work we're doing around systems changes, making sure that people have access to facilities or recreational spaces or safe, equitable opportunities for active transportation. That there's a larger policy ecosystem where we're working on those issues. But I hope that answers all your questions. I may have missed something, so please let me know if I did.
Thank you. I think you just touched on them all.
Yeah, and I will add that the seasonality issue, you know, there's kind of a hibernation that sometimes happens, and it seems to be more of a older adult issue than a younger adult issue, and seems to increase with age. There's not a ton of research on that, but it does, that sort of seems to be the pattern. And you know, again, educating, you know, the part of this is to also educate individuals about being physically active throughout. So it is to kind of help address those issues. I don't think it's a major issue, but it is an issue. I had another point, but I lost it in there. So I apologize. Regards to sort of the individualization of exercise and exercise prescription, the 2018 guidelines, one of the things that it did include was, those with chronic conditions is to be as physically active as your condition allows, right? So if that's what your condition allows, then you're technically meeting the guidelines in terms of that. So it does take some clinical reasoning and decision-making on the far end and understanding the individual's condition. But that is actually included in the physical activity guidelines.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Ed. This is Steve Einar. I'm just going to interject. Wherever possible, please be sure to include a statement like that so things get coded by our friends in the HIT development world. They're cognizant of that because that's a very important fact that could easily get overlooked as people look to a particular standard and want to quantify things. And there are lots of conditions that I'm sure have variable aspects or highly variable measures in that space, and not getting ourselves in a position where there's a lower category of things to choose from or a lower or a smaller data set would be not helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'd also say that the alternative of the what's referred to as the PAV score, the physical activity vital signs score, you're given a score based on how much you're exercising, and that starts, and why we did not go that route, it becomes more programmatic that way and doesn't sort of allow for that variation. You just are given a low score, right? and this doesn't give you a score. It's just, this is what you're doing, and then you can have a discussion about it.
Thank you so much. I just want to note that we are at the end of our allotted time for this conversation, but we do have some critical voices to come. If we can have our next questions be brief in order to allow the full time allocated to our next speakers, that would be great. Noting the critical voice, next, Nedra, speaking from the CDC, we welcome your comments.
Sure, thank you. I just wanted to further emphasize our support of this of physical activity as a really important health behavior that we should include in routine clinical practice, and that there are four loincoats that have been identified. I specifically want to ask about the one regarding the calculated measure to get at the full recommendation of the American Heart Association around 150 minutes. So is this calculated variable, calculated value done automatically for populating that point code?
Can you answer that? I think Lloyd's the best person to answer that. Do you still have
one? Busy answering a question in chat, and I did not hear the question online.
So, Lloyd, our question was about the the loin code that multiplies minutes, right? Of just to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the main reason that we wanted to have the calculated value exposed is it makes it a lot easier to search to find who is within guideline versus not. There's no good mechanism in FHIR to search by a multiplication. And so having that as a stored searchable measure makes life a whole lot easier in terms of quickly trying to find what are the patients that I have that are potentially not in range and determining how you want to engage with those.
And Lloyd, that loin code already exists, or do we need to refine? Yeah, so we're all set there.
So I just want to note, Nedra's question was whether it happened automatically. Does that answer the comment of the automatic calculation of that final?
Yeah, I mean, we would expect systems would gather the two factors and determine the total automatically in much the same way as they would add up the pieces for an APGAR or something like that. You don't have to enter that separately.
That's the way Kaiser does it now, and others like Intermountain Health do it.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to make sure we got that element. And again, just because of timing, I can see that Stephen moved his comment to the chat, but if we can quickly move through the last couple comments, that'd be great so we can move on to the next elements. Hans?
Hello, good morning, and thanks for the update. Question that I have, and part of that might follow through, is the scope of the USCDI proposal. Is it around the three loin codes and the physical activities to be able to record that, if you will, as observations? Or is it something more, because the references and the discussion includes very much indications of the implementation guide that's still to be balloted, reviewed, et cetera, that includes elements of the care plan, questionnaire, workflow ask. What's really the scope that's being asked for in USCDI?
Yeah, great question.
Not because the discussion and the submission give the impression that it's more than, let's say, three observations of three or four different loin codes.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Hans. I mentioned it at the beginning that we are in the USCDI application focused on the assessment part of the implementation guide. So we're these core measures are what constitutes our application to USCDI.
And that would be great if that can be clarified when we say that, what exactly are they? So I understand conceptually the focus, but what's then specifically the subset of the IG in progress that's being looked at to say that's timely to put it in USCDI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the implementation guide is deals with the full spectrum of care across assessment, prescription, and referral, but this fundamental piece of assessing physical activity is what we hope to get into the core measures, because this starts the conversation, it starts the patient on their journey.
Thank you. Yeah, a link to exactly what subset of the guide that would be.
It's the primary measures. I'll put in a link.
Oh, that would be great. So that there's no confusion as to where it is.
Thank you, Hans.
But Hans, this is Al. Just to be clear, the data element in USCDI is a data element that only captures and exchanges physical activity information, and only that. And that's what American Heart Association submitted, and we actually carried through that into the implemented data element. We could potentially modify the coverage, but the very specific coverage of that data element is only the assessment and results of the assessment of physical activity.
And I appreciate that as the clarification that it just has been hard between the submission and the documentation made available and the discussion to understand exactly what the scope is around that statement.
And I think the American Heart Association submission, you know, points to how this might be exchanged through the, you know, in what's covered in the IG. But as I think most people know, USCDI does not specify how things should be exchanged, only that they would eventually need to be exchanged using a FHIR US Core IG and/or a CCDA IG. That's clear. Their suggestion about how it might be is really informative to ONC and to the general public about how feasible this is, how feasible the exchange would be, and what would the burden on development be. So we appreciate that pointing to a very concrete IG at whatever stage in development, because they appear to have solved, answered the question about feasibility of exchange.
And I thank you, Lloyd, for pointing to the section that's actually applicable for the scope of the request. That's actually very helpful to the subsets.
No problem.
Okay, so we thank you so much for the conversation. We have hopefully one last brief comment or question.
I think mine has been addressed in the discussion. I missed the start of the conversation. Brian Karras, no conflicts. Wanted to make sure that if it's not included in this round, if we have a plan for how to incorporate wearables and personal health devices. So, been addressed.
Thank you so much, Brian. There really is very robust conversation in the chat regarding that, and I appreciate that. Luckily, we'll capture that in our minutes. At this time, it's appropriate, I think, to just thank our friends from AMA and our friend Lloyd McKenzie from Dogwood for leading us in a deep dive on the work of the physical activity work in HL7. They came at our request, because when we were originally reviewing this element, we had two questions, one regarding the measures and one regarding the status of the IG. And I believe both of those have been addressed in this presentation. Again, thank you so much, a team from AHA and Lloyd, for coming today. And we are moving to our next guest, which again was at our request. This is a deep dive in medication instructions and medication adherence with our guest, Scott Robertson, who we asked to come after last week's meeting. Next slide, please. All right, Scott, are you ready to speak?
My mute button didn't work the first time. Good morning, welcome, everybody. I put this slide together quickly just because we seemed to have a lot of discussion last week about the textual SIG and the components of SIG, the individual codified elements that can be present. And also because it's important to make sure that the current e-prescribing systems that are based upon NCPP script and the FHIR representations that are used in many of the EHRs, even though the EHRs end up using script to send it, but you need to be able to see how they interrelate to each other. And there actually are, in both cases, there are really two places where there's a global textual form available for both, and that's the SIG text on the left and the rendered dosage instructions on the right that are representing script and FHIR. And that is should be the fully encompassing everything that's being told to the patient. Within that, both script and FHIR support multiple sets of instructions. And that may not seem obvious at first because, you know, you normally see something like take one capsule four times a day or take one tablet every other day. But it's actually very common to have multiple SIGs comprising the entire SIG, such as take one tablet Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the morning, and take two tablets Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and skip Sunday. That's actually three different sets of instructions that then go into the entire SIG. They both support that. On the left side, that's where it shows instruction and then multiple instruction modifiers and more instructions. And on the right, it's that whole group of elements starting from sequence and going down through dose and rate. So I didn't think you really needed to see how all the little pieces go together, but I just wanted to show that there are these two different parts. But I really think at this point in time, the idea of providing the SIG is that global SIG text that is represented and available on both.
Thank you so much, Scott. I believe you answered specifically, you were a present at the last meeting, so you came back specifically to answer the elements that we asked you to. Any further thought there, or should we open it up for comments? Scott, are you ready to open it up for comments to the committee?
My mute button went back on, I don't know why. no, that's fine. Because really, there was that specific question. Mm-hmm. This sort of lays it out.
Yeah.
And I think other comments are welcome.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Scott. On to Shelley, appropriately.
Thank you, Scott. And thank you so much for bringing in the more technical portion of the directions for use, which is an important component. As pharmacists, we must have that information readily available and exchangeable, not only from the standpoint of patient education, but also for sharing that information with the care team. also during transitions of care. There are many components of the directions for use that are extremely important. And I know that we've had a structured SIG availability for many years in NCPDP. As we move forward with using the directions or including medication information into other areas besides just generating a prescription, we include the directions for use in the care plan, at least the pharmacist electronic care plan, where we're exchanging the clinical information with the care team. And these are important components moving forward that we try to codify the information mostly for patient safety and assuring that the pharmacist who is going to be dispensing that medication or educating the patient has clear understanding of what those directions are. So I commend you for coming in and thank you very much. My question is, what you brought forward is mostly on the e-prescribing side. Can you talk about how we technically use the directions for use in other types of fire resources, such as the electronic care plan?
Of course. So within an electronic care plan in fire, the same structures are available. The dosage data type, which is the bottom two thirds on the right, is used in a number of different resources to provide support for dosage instructions. I don't quite recall if the rendered dose instructions are also replicated across, but the sequence of texts for the individual dosage elements would still be available. The use of the where well, what we need right now is to support the instructions. If this information is going to be used for things like clinical decision support and dosage, confirming that a dosage has been adjusted appropriately for other conditions the patient has, then the codified elements really become very necessary to know, because the breaking down, parsing out the textual representation can become very difficult.
One other question on that, Scott, is we know that the directions for use have to go into medication administration records, and we do have a fire standard for med administration. How are the directions for use put into the fire for medication administration?
It's the same.
Or is it med statement? I can't remember.
Well, there is the dosage, that same dosage structure. Well, a simplified dosage structure is present in administration. This same structure that you see is on administration and dispense. For the medication statement, I'm just confirming, yes, they have both the rendered dosage instruction and dosage. That, because in that sense, it actually might be something that can be pulled into that medication statement resource instance. But if not, it's something that can, you know, is something that the patient would communicate to whoever is taking the medication history. And so it may end up being, you know, just typed in to that history record. So it's available in all of the medication related resources. And I don't really think it's used widely in other for other resources.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Scott. On to Hans.
Thank you. And thank you, Scott, for that that perspective. It's very helpful to have the diagram, which similar question as I had in the prior section for L, I think might be best. As Scott described in the medication request, the prescription, the need for medication instruction, and provided this perspective, which is a subset of the discussion in the submission and in various discussion prior, very focused on this. Is that meant to be the request for a suggestion to go into USCDI and the rest is context? Or is more than this being asked for to go into USCDI in beyond medication request, i.e. prescription, into other elements, if not potentially up to the pharmacist care plan guide that is also referenced in the submission? What's really the scope? Is this it or is there more?
Well, I would say it's, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I think the question was to me, right, Hans?
Yes, Al, just to put it in the context of how you were looking at constructing the draft and what was meant to be the proposal, recognizing that there's many other elements to it as described, that's very helpful, but this seems to represent what is being proposed, correct?
Yeah, this is, yes, and this is one source of medication instruction. This is one format of medication instruction. And there are other formats of medication instruction we've discussed in the past, including things like patient reports how they're taking the medication, or what the patients believe to be the instructions for use, or what is their over-the-counter package say about dosing. Those are all sources of medication instruction that can be relayed by the patient or to the patient, not specifically the NCPDP codified SIG. So that is the scope of the USCDI data element. The intent of that is to be, I would say, broader than script codified SIG, because just, I'll stop there. That's the scope of the data element. I'll stop.
I appreciate that clarification. It would be helpful then to maybe have that further clarification what that subset is, and what you just described is very helpful to understand that it might not be clear to everybody reviewing the draft as to that's the intent versus the full pharmacist care plan, for example. So that's the rationale behind the question, to ensure that we understand what's being asked for. Thank you.
Thank you, Hans. Before I move off to Brent, I believe, and I don't want to put, Pooja is back. I believe this was one of the elements that we had some work going on the sidelines for the subgroup to work on some of those definitional elements as well. Just want to note, I think I remember that was work that was happening in the interim, but they just kicked off that work.
And I believe that is for adherence, but it might be helpful for instructions to do them the same.
Yes. Okay. Got it.
Whatever it is.
Thank you, Hans.
And one thing just to throw out in terms of adherence that Hans just mentioned is that adherence in FHIR is simply a code and an optional reason, and it maps to a set of SNOMED codes, a subset of SNOMED codes.
Thank you, Scott. Any other comments on the specific presentation and the questions we had that stemmed from last week's review of the data elements and reference? Oh, great. It looks like Shelley's stating they're meeting both on medication instruction and adherence. Fantastic. Subgroup. All right. Sorry. Naresh, yeah?
Let me ask the question. If you can just take a question, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Was that to me? My question was, has there been a a mapping or a check that after these the MCC PDP scripts have been mapped to FHIR, can they still successfully be leveraged and utilized in activities such as the prescription drug monitoring program reporting that relies on those instructions to calculate morphine equivalent doses? Has anybody taken that? I realize it's a secondary use of this, but it has significant consequences on our public health use cases for the the end product of these kinds of data elements. Over.
Well, I can just mention that basically everybody has to be using script to communicate this information, and at least the SIG text at this point. More and more installations have been using the codified portions of SIG, script. They can be used as part of the medication equivalent dose for reporting that a pharmacy does. I'm not quite sure if e-prescribing systems, the prescriber side, use it in the same manner. They're typically going to be doing it from their native data, which is then either represented in script or FHIR, depending on how they're communicating it with other systems. So both of these could support it, but I can't say that either one is being used specifically for that transition or that reporting. And Shelley, I don't know, Shelley might know a bit more.
Yes, this is Shelley. I believe that in the PDMP data feed that pharmacies send, I mean, they can send the directions for use today, text-based, but there are other data elements that would lead to the calculation of morphine milliequivalents and dose based off of other features that are captured. I can't put my finger on what that data element is, but as pharmacists are bringing PDMP data into a registry, there are certain data elements that have been defined in order. And it is in all cases, this isn't necessarily the need for a text-based direction for use or instructions.
Right. It's that dilemma that it exists as optional in the specification because it's not always needed, but in the use case for opioid prescribing, it's no longer optional because if those data elements are missing, then we can't fully calculate out. So I'm just wondering if we might be missing some data elements that could become, critical once people start adopting this.
Thank you so much. We are nearing the end again of our allotted time for this presentation. Any other further comments and questions? It looks like Shelley has her hand up. Shelley?
Yes, I just wanted to respond to the comment that was just made. There are many, many data elements that pharmacies capture. Because there are some pharmacies that submit using claims-based data, they've added more codified fields into that feed for those who are using claims to feed into PDMP. So having the full direction for use is not necessarily needed in all cases for things like PDMP, but it might be needed for things like medication reconciliation or more clinical exchange of information. I know Kim Boyd has has added a couple of links in there on some of the NCPDP standards that might be useful to answer this question.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Are we ready to close out this element of the conversation? And then proceed to our next topic, which is moving on to some loose ends from USCD IV draft elements and level two. Seems so. So Scott, thank you so much for coming so quickly, given that we identified we wanted to hear your voice last week. We really appreciate this presentation as it directly answered one of the questions we had regarding the range of possible documentation, everything from free text to FHIR. So thank you so much. Okay, on to comments and recommendations, level two. This is when we have a little bit of time for public comment to loop around on some elements that were identified in previous meetings, hopefully, and also to try to start diving into those level two elements that have been suggested by work group members. If we can go to the Google Doc at this time, so that Al, are you ready to share as you do?
I am. I'm just trying to get a cleaner view. Here we go. If I could share, please. And here we go. I pulled up the first level two data element, and there's others that are still under discussion that are part of draft V4, and we are going to come back to those in future discussions. But I'm starting, unless you want to go somewhere else, Sarah and Naresh, I'm starting with entry 21, the first level two data element that was not included in USCDI.
If it's okay, I would like to start someplace else, only because I'm picking up a thread from a previous meeting, and at least making sure the work groups are aware of the status of something that we asked them to do prior. Is it okay to go to the procedure time USCDI V4 element, just so that at least the committee can be socialized, the workgroup can be socialized to the work that Hong and colleagues did regarding the definitions we requested. Sorry for the brief hijacking. Entry number 16 was time of procedure. And if we recall, we very clearly identified that there really were two critical elements within time of the procedure as a laboratory element. And we asked a subgroup to go out and figure out definitions for those. And Hung, sorry to put you on the spot, but if we go over to workgroup discussion, you can see that the first element in the workgroup discussion at this time are the definitions that that Hung and colleagues created for those elements. I think, there we go, right there. It's hard to find it in Google Sheets because it flips back and forth, but you can see, Hung, are you ready to discuss the findings of that subcommittee?
Yes. And so we did review the existing submission for procedure time. And we also looked at the other level two elements associated with the laboratory. But we thought that it would be best to have two new elements that are not meant to replace procedure time, but would be complementary. And these would be the laboratory results report time. And this represents the time when the testing is completed. And this is required for CLIA on all reports. And so this is the time when the testing is completed and the results are reported out. Not necessarily to the EHR, but it's when the laboratory verifies that the testing is done. Secondly, is the specimen collection date and time. So this is necessary because this really represents the clinically relevant observation time. If blood is drawn today, put on ice, and then tested tomorrow for chemistry, what the results represent is the status of the patient's chemistry today when it was drawn, not tomorrow when it's performed. And so this is essential for interpretation of the results. And for both data elements, we felt strongly that they should be able to accommodate time zone differences if they don't already.
Just a deep thanks to everyone who participated in this exercise. So just for clarity, so these, and I just want to note that this, there is a level two element that was suggested below that kind of correlates to this. I think it was entry number 26. So can you really clearly specify what the recommended elements would be out of this exercise? Procedure time plus, and then plus, just so that we can make sure that we get it on record.
Yes, so we don't want to replace procedure time. So we agree with keeping procedure time, but specific to laboratory, we would have a laboratory result report and also specimen collection, because I think procedure time can be applied to things outside the laboratory. And so that's why we don't necessarily want to withdraw that.
That makes a lot of sense. Any discussion on this work that our colleagues have done?
This is Steve Eitner. From a public health perspective, there is value in understanding when the laboratory or testing facility actually receives the sample from the ordering physician or the performing practitioner for public health in terms of looking at delays in delivery or processing, and helps public health identify what the queue backup is at the testing facility. And that is really, really useful from a public health perspective. Additionally, there needs to be probably linguistical guidance about what is the timestamp on procedure as to whether it's the actual time the sample is taken or whether it's the time stamp a label is printed in that space, because it also makes a huge difference, especially if there is a significant delay in looking at printing a sample, label, and data being collected. Again, that might happen in a situation for an emergency where you're collecting a large, or whether you're, where you're serving a large amount of people and pre-printing labels. It really becomes, again, important both from a public health perspective and a care delivery perspective to understand the true difference in time between sample collecting and sample processing. Brian, do you have anything to add in that space? Brian, you still with us?
I was distracted.
Okay.
So Brian, we were discussing about the value of having a timestamp for when a testing facility actually receives the sample, and guidance about, you know, a timestamp on procedure reflecting that it's actually the procedure time, not just a label stamp, or being clear about what procedure time actually is.
Yeah, for absolutely, because that, if that's, you know, specimen sat for 2 days, then the collection time is, and the run time could be wildly different in terms of understanding risk of transmission from that date forward. So yeah, critical that we get the timings correct.
And again,
just correct me if I'm wrong. I think that these two data elements, as Hung has presented them, do accomplish that task of differentiating between when it was run. Report is equivalent to result performed, or result date time is roughly equivalent to that when it was run. And the specimen collection time differentiates between when it was run and when it was collected.
From a public health perspective, having a timestamp about when the laboratory or testing facility actually receives a sample is incredibly valuable, because that identifies, or can help identify, if there is a gap in getting the sample from the test, from the extraction point to the facility, or whether there's a backlog in facility testing.
Have you documented those comments in the work group discussion in the share drive yet?
It was brought up briefly, but I wanted to make it was important, I thought, to bring it up in the broader conversation.
It does seem important. I'm wondering if you can help by putting that in the document so it can at least, even if we don't move forward with an element, that we can at least document it as part of critical discussion, especially given this moment in time.
My pleasure. I just wanted confirmation in a larger, larger group that it was indeed important.
So I advocated for this in our small group discussion. This is Raj Dash. I was educated a little bit that the two, and I agree that the two most important date time elements are the specimen collection date and the final report date. Final report date, as Dr. Liu pointed out, is because it's required by CLIA, and the collection date and time is the only way to interpret the sequence of events. Like if you're doing multiple arterial blood gases, the collection date time is the only way to tell the sequence of events because they might all be reported out at different times, depending on the analyzer it's put on, those kinds of things. So those are the two most critical. There are additional date time elements, such as the date time received in the laboratory, that I agree are helpful, but we kind of put it in a second tier, if you will. And I would love to get many more data elements, but thinking of the USCDI as kind of the floor of what we need and where we're at right now with these two date time elements, we felt that needed to be prioritized. I actually raised my hand because there's an error here. The first sentence in the justification says the date time procedure could be used. That was my old way of thinking, but in discussion, the procedure date time, could be a surgical date time. We need to delete that line. We probably shouldn't say that because we speak to just the opposite in the work group discussion now. So we will delete that. I can probably delete that later if everyone agrees to that. The procedure date time should be kept separate from the collection date time and from the report date time. And the other comment you made, Stephen, was about the time in which you print a label versus the time in which you actually collect the specimen. Unfortunately, one does serve as a surrogate for the other in most EHR platforms, and I don't know that we can be prescriptive about how EHRs implement these data elements. That's probably outside the scope of USCDI, as far as I know. But it's true, just for the general education of the group, that the print label date time is what's used as the collection date time in most EHR implementations and lab systems.
And again, those two data points may be very useful from a care delivery standpoint, not taking anything away from that. However, there are other users of data, including public health, in a variety of different ways, including supporting care delivery. And from a public health response perspective, understanding if there is a delay in processing samples is really, really important. As we saw looking at COVID-19 response, there were oft times a backlog of tests held at particular testing facilities. And if we are informed of that backlog or aware of that kind of backlog, we can take action to help redirect some of those test processing components. So that really does become important.
Thank you so much. I want to give space for the fact that the subgroup did what we asked them to do. So one of the things I want to see is if we can get to consensus on recommendation after we hear a few more other comments, based on the fact that the group took time to do really excellent work in exactly what we requested. Al?
Shelley has her hand up. I don't know if that still applies.
Yeah. Oh, I have you above her, but I'm happy to do whatever. Shelley?
Go ahead, Al, if you need to.
So just a real quick question. So the wording of the recommendation, I just want to be really, really clear from among those two data elements, to me, appear to be already submitted as data elements. And the exact use of the wording is slightly different in the names of the data elements, but lab result report date and time and specimen collection date and time are both level two data elements in the laboratory data class. Is your recommendation to add those to USCDI before, or are you, do you not think that those accurately represent what you think ought to be captured?
We definitely do not think the name accurately reflects what we want. And so that is part of the reason for not trying to revise the level two elements. Instead, we would like to use these names. And then the second one, the specimen collection date and time, is actually a combination of two of the level two elements. And so they don't necessarily fit nicely into what has already been submitted.
Is that clear? So, Al, from a recommendation perspective, before we go to Shelley.
Yeah, it is. We do have, ONC does from time to time exercise some latitude in shaping data elements to be more appropriate for the request. So there is also a possibility that the data elements can be, because sometimes ONC's intent is to have a data element be different or broader mm-hmm. than was submitted, for example. So there is still the possibility that we could modify the data elements as submitted to meet more specific needs.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. If you can modify what's been submitted to meet these needs, then that would be ideal.
Because the names are pretty close. I understand that they're not exactly what you were looking for, but the names are pretty close. And to me, the intent is pretty close, but maybe not quite right.
And we do certainly renaming and redefining US B4 and level two elements is within our charge. So although these are comments on improvements on existing level two elements, it sounds like we have a path forward for addressing those level two as we go forward with these recommendations. At least that's what I hear from Al. Shelley?
Yes, I actually joined this subgroup, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, wanted to know more about how the date time stamp, which is really important in relationship to medications, but also we have many pharmacies throughout the United States that do collect laboratory data on multiple levels, and wanted to make sure that we understood from the pharmacist standpoint how we need to make sure that we're following the CLIA and that we are assuring that we can move forward with this. In relationship to collecting data and knowing the time when the data is collected and knowing the time that might be a discrepancy in time that could cause erroneous data to be transmitted, I think there are other methods of explaining that a sample could have an issue. And I think that that would be an appropriate way. We also have to think about how that lab data is actually collected within a system to feed into an interoperable exchange. And I think we have to take that into consideration of how the actual clinicians are capturing the lab data within their systems and using date and time stamps. And I think we had those discussions during the subcommittee. And I think we need to be aware that there are locations out there who are collecting this type of information that might not have sophisticated clinical documentation systems to other than a timestamp on when the label is printed or other aspects to be able to share that in an interoperable way. And I think we need to take that into consideration as we discussed during the subcommittee. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I just want to note, so Clem, you've raised your hand. Do you have, we just want to make sure that you put it down. Do you have anything to say on this topic? Just to make sure we're centering you.
You can drop that.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right, so I feel like we do have some clarity. It's about, first of all, again, very, very grateful for the work of the subgroup. And we have a few more minutes before we go to public comment. Thank you for patience and revisiting this before we moved on to level two, because it did seem fairly critical as we gave a request to our subgroup. Are we further to a point where we can say we have consensus for recommendation of procedure time and now the associated level two elements, given the work of the subgroup? Any concerns for moving forward with a recommendation from the committee?
Not here.
Hearing no concerns, is it appropriate to understand that as consensus?
Go for it.
Yoo-hoo! Okay. Incredibly grateful for the work of the committee in giving and responding to the request for clarity, and grateful to move forward that element into consensus recommendation, noting that all the elements that of things yet to be determined are really critical for discussion, and if those folks can put them into the comments in the worker discussion so we can include it in our final report, that would be lovely. We have a couple more minutes, not a ton. I think what would be helpful, I think maybe, would be to socialize everyone to the level two elements that have been submitted so far, so that we can not do any social, like do as little socialization as possible when we come back together, because we really are going to be trying to address the level two suggestions over the course of the next month in order to get our submission, our recommendations down back to HITACH. So if we can just quickly see, just run down the list and then move to public comment, I think that's probably a good idea. So from Mark Savage, we have submitted a patient summary and plan. I wanna make sure that everyone reviews the recommendation and the justification of the discussion and adds thoughts prior to our next meeting. From Grace, we have clinical notes, which is an existing level two element. Oh, Mark, do you want to say something?
Yes, I've been doing a lot of thinking about care plan, but there's not much there, as everybody can see. I'm committing to making sure that I've got that filled in this week. I'm just trying to connect a lot of dots. Thank you.
Oh, and it's understandable because we've been otherwise occupied in this committee as well. So again, so Mark, if we go back up one section again, sorry. Just one row so we can see Mark's element. Sorry, underneath patient summary and plan, Mark is working on care plan. Grace has submitted under clinical notes an operative note. And then,
sorry,
oh, I'm sorry, Al. Thank you. All right.
Wait a second. Oh no. Yeah, okay. So, okay, hang on. All right.
I think we're good. You sorted by entry. And then entry number 23 is the next entry, which is the one below. Grace submitted under a data class advanced directive, data element advanced directive. Under entry 24, Mark makes a general comment regarding a move that is part of USDIV 4, and everyone can review that. That would be helpful. Entry number 25, Mark resurfaces last year's ISWG recommendations for gender identity, sex for clinical use, recorded sex or gender and name to use and pronouns, which were the outcomes of the Gender Harmony Project from HL7. That's another level two element. And then Stephen Lane has a recommendation under laboratory for test interpretation. Some of this might be included in some of the conversation we had above. And then if we go down again, we don't have a ton of time, but if we go to public comment, if we can just scroll down. Some of the elements that, this is one of the elements that might be rolled into the discussion we just had. So prior to next week, if we can just see if any of the level two elements we have suggested here are resolved by a recommendation for procedure time and the associated new definitions, that would be helpful. Hans is asking if it'd be possible to populate column F for the level two proposals as well, a link to the submission, that is. Hans, yes, we can work on that. We'll work on that so we can do our homework. So we have 27, 28, and 29 under laboratory. Lab test report and date and time, test kit universal device identifier, And then we go down to Shelley's entry number 30, which is really a, really a recommendation that relating to the level two element that relates to the USCDI V4 up above. So we'll integrate that into our revisiting of substance use and alcohol use, substance use, and the other elements that we had documented up above when we revisit USCDI V4 elements above. And then Shelley has a comment on medication adherence, which I think is part of Pooja's subgroup. And then medication instructions. So if anyone, if for all of these elements, these level two elements, if your concerns have been addressed by the decisions happening up above in USCDI V4, if you can add comments prior to our next meeting, that would be helpful. And then Aaron, in entry number 33, has under care team members, provider NPI. I believe that's almost all of them. Al, am I missing anything? Do we have an entry past 34? Oh, we have a provenance element. So again, I don't want to delay going into public comment. So we do have to go, but just everyone, please look at level two elements before next meeting, because we do want to make sure that when we hit the ground with the conversation on level two, we're ready to go. Specifically, try to make sure that if your level two suggestions have been addressed by previous conversations, that you note that so that we can make sure to move on. Moving on to public comment.
All right, thanks, Sarah. We're gonna open up our meeting for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the raise hand function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public raise their hand. Not seeing any raised hands. Sarah, so I'll turn it back to you. Oh, we do have one. So let's just pause and turn the call over to Maria Mullen. You have 3 minutes.
Hi there. I hope that you can hear me okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So I am the use case project lead for the Advanced Directive Interoperability with Fire project within HL7. And the data class, if you will, of Advanced Directive enabling data exchange to have a specific area, container of data elements for this important information to move within, you know, is an area that I want you guys to give some thought and consideration to. We had seated the advanced directive observation. So within this overarching category of advanced directives, you might have a clinical observation of what exists. I can see in the draft V4 that the care experience preference made it over. And then there's an advanced directives data element, which disappeared from level two to draft V4, we definitely appreciate, under draft V4, the treatment intervention preference and the care experience preference. So it is probable that losing the advanced directive data element in exchange of those two more specific data element descriptions is absolutely, fine with the groups that have been working on this. But I am curious about seating those two under goals as opposed to the data class of advanced directives, so as to more accurately confine that information. So I don't know where I'm at on 3 minutes, but those are my comments.
Thank you, Maria. Does anyone want to respond from ONC or Sarah on Arish?
Looks like Al has
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Maria Mullen for her comments and support for the data elements that we've added. The reason that we added, care experience preference and treatment intervention preference to the goals category is because it seemed to fit into the PASIO model of categorizing goals, preferences, and priorities into a single group. That said, goals is a preference and a goal are not exactly the same. They may or may not be synonymous, but they are similar, at least in our look, our thoughts. But that's the reason that we put it in goals, because there is a group of data called goals, preferences, and priorities that seem to kind of travel together.
Hey, thanks, Al. Sarah, do you want to close us out?
I certainly can. I want to thank everybody for the great work that happened today. Thank everybody for the work that happened in interim. Looking forward to some other guest speakers and subject matter experts next week again, and hoping we lean deeply into the level two elements that we have on our charter. Looking forward to seeing you all next week, and thank you so much for your time. Naresh, any other final thoughts?
No, again, just want to reiterate, thanks a lot for the subgroup that worked on this, and we'll meet you again next week.